All right, are you ready?
I am.
All right, let's do this.
Welcome to Missouri Marvels, Humanities, Discovery, and Innovation, Episode 2. In this season, we're exploring the possibilities of human progress and cultural evolution, journeying through history to showcase Missouri trailblazers and technological advancements, illuminating the transformative power of discovery and innovation, and navigating the complexities and challenges of an ever-changing world. What in the world, no pun intended, do you ask an astronaut? As we began planning our podcast episodes for this season, we figured talking to someone in this field would be a great way to bridge the humanities and STEM, which is a major goal of this year's signature series, especially if that astronaut is from Missouri, and her post-NASA career is as a professor at the University of Missouri. My guest is Dr. Linda Godwin. Godwin is a professor emeritus at the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Missouri in Columbia. She taught in the department for 8 years after retiring from NASA in 2010. Selected by NASA as an astronaut candidate in June 1985, Dr. Godwin became an astronaut in July 1986. A veteran of 4 space flights, Dr. Godwin has logged over 38 days in space, including over 10 EVA hours in 2 spacewalks, and she's a Missourian through and through. She grew up in Jackson, Missouri, and holds a PhD in physics from the University of Missouri, a Master's of Science degree from the University of Missouri, and a Bachelor of Science degree in Mathematics and Physics from Southeast Missouri State. Dr. Godwin, it is a thrill to talk with you. Thank you for being willing to share your stories and perspective with Missouri Humanities. I imagine it's not often that our listeners get to hear from an actual astronaut who's been to space. And I looked at your NASA bio, and you've logged 38 days in space. So that's not just you've been to space. You've spent quite a bit of time there. I'm not even sure where to really begin. I'm really excited to dive into this with you. So something we love at Missouri Humanities is when we get to tell fascinating stories with and about Missourians. It's not often that, you know, we get to tell stories of people who are still here that we're able to sit across the room from each other and actually talk with. Can we start by talking about your beginnings in Missouri and your path to NASA and ultimately beyond?
Well, thanks, Caitlin. It's fun. Going to be fun to do this and to talk to you. And yeah, Missouri is my state. I'm from Southeast Missouri. I grew up in a little town outside of Jackson, Missouri, which is near Cape Girardeau. And yeah, I didn't know where I would end up. I didn't think about it much when I was really young, I guess. But when I grew up there, I really did like math and science. I watched the early NASA stuff. I mean, I'm talking, you know, really early. I was in elementary school, you know, with Mercury and Gemini. And then we landed on the moon right before my senior year in high school, to date myself.
Really integral timing.
But, you know,
life.
I mean, those were times that was just really extraordinary to watch. My parents weren't in anywhere near those fields or, you know, higher education or anything, but they were, you know, we watched all that because they were really interested in it. Had good science and math teachers. I don't know. I just got into math and science, and in the back of my mind, you know, I'm sure I thought about NASA, but what would be the path there? And all the astronauts were men, and back then, and mostly military pilots. So, you know, this was not my, you know, what I ever, it couldn't work for me, right? Mm-hmm. So, but when I went to college at SEMO, I majored in physics and math, also liked the music department there. I was in that, you know, a lot of the music stuff. And then I decided to come to grad school because I just didn't feel like I was finished. And so I was fortunate to get in here at the University of Missouri in Columbia, and this is where I came after college to work on a PhD in physics. And then, you know, whatever aligned, the stars, as they say, or whatever, but NASA started hiring, along toward the end of my time here, for the shuttle program. They were finally hiring astronauts again, and they were actively recruiting women to be part of the group. So that became, you know, something that was a little more clear-cut, and I decided I would go for that. I decided I'd start working on my private pilot's license, and I did some extra tutoring. And, you know, really people say, how do you get to be an astronaut? Well, everybody has a different path. The opportunity has to be there. which it wasn't for a while. And then you have to decide you're going to apply. And if you don't apply, you're 100% never getting there, right?
Yeah.
And if you do apply, the odds are still long. But anyway, I did my first interview. I still had a couple years to go in grad school anyway, and I didn't get in that year. But I interviewed 2 years later for their third astronaut class. And I at least got an interview, and I got to go to Houston, Texas, and see the Johnson Space Center and spend time with people down there, and I really enjoyed that. And I still didn't get in. Guess what? You got to keep trying. But they offered me a job. So I'm out of grad school. I had 2 job offers. They were both in Texas. But I thought, you know, if I'm really serious about NASA, I need to take that one and go down. And so I worked in mission operations for a while and supported the shuttle program, learned a lot about what it meant to work there, what was going on, and got in another class. So I don't know, opportunities, persistence
definitely sounds like it,
and some luck, because you know, I mean, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So you're, you know, born and bred Missourian. I love that you're back in Missouri now. But how did growing up in Missouri, receiving your education here, inspire you to want to go out and explore space? You know, I think it's interesting that a lot of people say that their goal in their career is to get out of their hometown and go explore other places, but you took it so many levels higher as far as, you know, getting outside your hometown and getting out and exploring. So what was the inspiration?
I think it was just because I wanted to do the space stuff, and they didn't do that in Jackson, you know? I mean, so really I had to go where the job was, and how I got started on that really was just, you know what else? I also just enjoyed reading. I was a big reader as a kid. And I've read a lot of science fiction, which doesn't, you know, connect to reality often, but it's where you dream and you think of stories and you just think of doing other things. You can have all these great stories set in different environments because now the imagination is bigger in those stories, right, I think. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to, it's one step at a time. And I guess, you know, trying to be reflective and looking back, it was sort of a meandering walk, and I got where I really was happy to be. You just try to do the next best thing that aligns with. I mean, I wasn't necessarily thinking, oh, I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
It was just more like, I want to do this, and I have to go here
in order to do it. Very interesting. I love it's kind of almost romantic that, you know, kind of what you bring up of, you know, going into space and that career path is, you know, otherworldly, obviously, but it's almost that escape from reality. It's like a dream because it seems, you know, especially, you know, several years ago when the space program was younger, it's almost like being able to make the history as it was happening because not a lot had been happening yet. So I imagine that's such an interesting, you know, piece of your life and of your story to be able to say that, you know, you were part of explorations that maybe hadn't happened yet or were groundbreaking for the next generation. And I think that's so cool. So talk about being in NASA. You have the time you spent in space and then kind of your transition from being an astronaut to where you are now.
Yeah, so 30 years at NASA, how to condense that? Well, first of all, I was so thrilled, you know, to get to work for NASA. But I will say when I left Columbia on a super, super hot August day, can I just give the year? It was so long ago, but it was 1980.
Mm-hmm.
We were making like hotspot in the nation that kind of August. I mean, you wouldn't remember.
No.
But anyway, so I'm just leaving August. I mean, I'm leaving Columbia, which I really, really liked. And I'm going to Houston, Texas, which I've only spent that one weekend for a couple of weeks for an interview, you know. And gosh, I thought, and then I drove all the way down there to Houston, and it was just so different. And I missed Missouri a lot. I missed the seasons. I missed, you know, the fall and rolling, things that weren't so flat.
Yeah.
But then I grew these roots down there for 30 years. You know, it was really, it took some time, but there's a lot going on in Houston, and NASA was a great place to be. So in those years, you know, I got to fly in space 4 times. Those were, you know, the highlights I have to tell people. But as you pointed out, 38 hours, 40 years. So most of my time there was working with the people. You know, it was all about training and working out what you're going to do next, supporting other programs, working in teams, our training team, our mission control team, our fellow astronauts, you know, fellow scientists and engineers down there. So really some of the best parts were just the human interactions, right? And people who were working there because they really wanted to be a part of that program. But I kept my ties up back here at the university, and I was on a couple of boards, and I'd come back for some physics things, and I just always just had a heart, you know, for this campus too. I liked being on it as a student. And this is when I finally left home, was when I went to grad school. So that was sort of, you know, extra. Along, you know, as I neared the end of my time there, and I kind of had thought 30 years would be it. It's sort of a retirement thing number. And, you know, by the time my husband and I and our young daughter, there was a window of opportunity in the age that she was, I thought there was a possibility they would offer me something here at the department. I could come back, and my husband would get to go into engineering, work over in the engineering college, and it just sort of all came together. And so we pulled up our stakes and those roots that were a little deeper than I thought down there in Houston, and came back to Missouri. And he was from the Midwest as well, so it kind of felt like coming back home. It was very different, and I thought, this is a whole different career and job, and I think a lot of people do this often. It's not so normal now to just stay 30 years in one spot, absolutely, working for one person or for one entity, you know, NASA. So I think a lot of people uproot and move all the time, but it was a pretty big deal for us to do that. But, you know, it was, I really enjoyed it. And so it was really the job I had that they were interested in me, you know, coming and bringing some of that back to the students here that opened up this opportunity. So I think when people go through their lives, you know, different doors open up that you didn't really think about when you chose the path you were going. But I've gotten to meet so many different people, you know, and I've gotten to go to places around the world, and I've got to come back here to this campus. And did I have that all planned out? No. I mean, does anybody? I think there are a few people out there who really, you know, have the 20 steps in their mind, you know, of how it's all going to go. But that wasn't my experience.
So when you came back to MU and started teaching, what is it you were teaching? Because thinking about the applied side of what you were doing at NASA and translating that experience into teaching, how was that?
Well, I did try to bring it in. And I mean, it was, I'd given a lot of talks. I mean, I'd been up in front of people a lot. But coming back and teaching a class, that was different. And I kind of also thought, man, all these students, you know, they're just all so sharp now, and I wonder what I still have. And then I discovered I could still, you know, hang in there. And so it is nice to know that you can still learn new things no matter how old you are. And I started out, I was teaching a large class. I had a couple hundred students, you know, of Gen Ed of Introduction to Astronomy, which wasn't exactly what I did. You know, human exploration of space and robotic exploration and astrophysics, it kind of connects because there's some study of the solar system there, but when you go farther afield, you know, you've got to branch out into the physics of astronomy and all of that. And I really, really, really enjoyed teaching that class. And then I put together a class called Physics of Space Exploration. And just how using the general concepts of physics, how do you even start about thinking about how would I travel around the solar system, you know, with the different masses of the planets and the sun's gravity. And because it occurred to me, you know, when I was all these space flights, and this is not this doesn't require deep thought at all, but you know, it's just all physics, you know, with how things move and orbits and trajectories and moving mass around, and with a lot of, you know, good engineering solutions. And of course, you know, the biology of the human beings that live there in space for a while, or, you know, the chemistry of the rocketry. I mean, it's all STEM related, but also, you know, the humanities factor into that because we worked with people from around the world in different cultures, and you have to understand where they're coming from and how do you convey things to the public. And there's an artistic element to that, as well as how do you verbally describe things. Or, you know, and we had some astronauts, this is so not me, who were very artistically talented, you know, and did, you know, who have, of course, a very well-known example was Alan Bean, who was one of the Apollo moonwalkers who came back, and he's a fabulous artist, He's unfortunately gone now, and I would love to be able to afford one of his paintings, but you know, they are like super, super high. But we've had other people come back and then paint about what they've seen. We have woman who now has a line of fabric design as a quilter that is inspired by what she saw in space. And so I've just worked with all these. I'm not sure where I'm rambling here or where I'm going.
No, I love it.
I, you know, worked with all of these people. Anyway, so you learn and you interact with all these people and you learn all these things and then come back to academia and it's, you got a lot of the same elements, you know. And it was really fun that students still wanted to talk to me and thought I was still relevant.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, yeah. Especially since it's still, and we kind of get to this later, but, you know, your career started back in, what, 1980, you mentioned? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, all this time later, it's still relevant and we're still talking about it. So, but I want to get to that more later. But something I do want to touch on, as I mentioned, this is this podcast episode is part of Missouri Humanities Signature Series this year, which is Missouri Marbles, Humanities, Discovery, and Innovation. And it's our goal this year to highlight the intersection of the humanities and science, technology, and kind of all that encompasses. As somebody who has worked the applied side, done the NASA thing, gone to space, worked with scientists and then came back to academia and started teaching the next generation and kind of weaving in that education and applied side of your career. Thinking on a bigger scale, what role do the humanities play in topics like space exploration, astronomy, physics, and other really STEM-oriented fields that are often associated more with things like science and discovery, and not so much those humanities topics? How do they link?
Yeah, you know, and I maybe touched on that a bit, but I mean, to me, it's because you have to share this with other people and you have to communicate it. And the technology, you know, we always focus a lot on the human space flight, but a lot of what we all use in our daily lives, no matter what we do, is the fact that we have communication satellites and interconnectivity around the world. And that is actually a lot of it's a part of what we've done in space and, you know, satellites that are up there, and we've enabled that. And, you know, there's a part of just looking back on our own planet that just touches the core of what you are. And I wish everybody could see that. And as I mentioned, you know, a lot of people come back very inspired to do art. And we have a lot of people that write about space. And a lot of people who are artists use space as an inspiration. I have a couple of, you know, prints in my house that I really like of really talented artists who like space art. There's a story to be told. There's a narrative. I think storytelling is a big part, actually, of the space community, because part of what we're supposed to do is share it with our fellow citizens, you know, whose money supports at least the part that's the government part and not the private part. People write, you know, space stories, and so there's writing and art, and really the history. We had on my second flight, it was an Earth science mission, and that we were looking at, we had a microwave frequency radar that was imaging different parts of the planet. But part of our, and I guess we didn't have to do it to fly the mission, but it made it so much more meaningful. We had classes that were set up to just, you know, about these sites we had to identify and do this science, and they always included with it the history of the people and why and how what we were looking at shaped the cultures that evolved there, you know, because it would, what if it's mountains, or, you know, it's more, or it's coastal, or it's more isolated. And it just talked a lot about the culture there, of the people that lived in these places. And I mean, I just found that fascinating. As an adult, I've gotten much more interested in history because it shapes where we are. And I mean, there's a history to spaceflight. And some of the earliest science history are the people looking up at the night sky and trying to figure out where are we. Mm-hmm. So there's just been that theme all the way through our culture. I don't know. I think it's all so intertwined. You really can't separate it.
Absolutely. And I love that you mentioned storytelling, because I agree that that has to be such an important factor of a career like yours and the experiences you've had, because there are so few people who've had those experiences. And I love that you feel the importance of sharing that with others. And I think that's such an integral part of the humanities, is that storytelling element, and helping people better understand other people. So I really appreciate that you brought that up. Kind of continuing on that conversation, how did being, you know, off earth, as we say, and dedicating so much time and effort to kind of these outside of earth ventures alter or affect your perception of the humanities or human connection, values, or the needs of humanity? How did that kind of, you know, change or inspire the way that you thought about it all?
Well, as you might imagine, growing up in Southeast Missouri, I didn't see a lot of people who weren't like me, you know, and particularly back then. It was more of that coming to the university. That was different. And then going to NASA, it became more and more international the more time I was there. So I had never really thought about, you know, how do you get along with these other cultures? And the science world does that too, you know, like academically, there's a lot of international collaboration, so you don't have to go to NASA to get it. But so the older I got, the more I was aware of how other people got to be where they were, and this is why they think that way. And I will say, you know, from being on orbit, one of the best memories when one had time to do it, because they were pretty busy days, more like a sprint on a shuttle mission. Mm-hmm. But when it was nighttime outside, and if there was time to, like, put favorite music on, we had always had something in headphones, we got to take some music and look out the window. We orbited at low Earth orbit where the shuttle went, going around and around. It was a few hundred miles high. It felt farther away, not because of distance, because it was complicated to get back. Mm. You know, so it felt farther, but yet floating there and watching an orbit go by in the daytime, it was beautiful. You know, you could see things and coastlines and deserts, but then when the sun set, as it did every time we went around, so there were 16 of those a day, then the city lights would come on, you know, and you look down there, and no matter, not over water, you know, but over the land masses, everywhere there was a little bit of light, and that showed where the people were, and that was just kind of fascinating to me, and you wonder, what are they doing, and I wish they could see this perspective of themselves, And I thought more about, you know, and how did they get to be there? Why do they live there? And
it gives me chills. Like, it's, I mean, that's, it's feeling connected when you're so far away. And yeah, and it's, you know, I think we've all kind of take that for granted, because how many times have we seen an image online of this is what the Earth looks like from space and the city lights and all that? I mean, I can picture in my head just from seeing it on the internet. But, you know, to actually, like you said, when you're winding down, and you get to just look out and think about the billions of people down there and their stories and their connections. And like you said, why are they there? Mm-hmm. I mean, that is the essence of human connection in the humanities.
And we're breathing the same air, you know, and we would see as the sun would have a sunrise or sunset, the layers of the atmosphere, which normally we really couldn't see looking down, but over to the side at a angle with the sun, behind that part of our, you know, the picture, you could see the different layers, and it's very thin compared to the size of the planet. And we're all breathing that air, you know, and it all intermixes. And we get to see it all because we're going around in 90 minutes. And everybody just feels like we ought to be a little closer together.
Yeah, yeah.
There have been one or two astronauts that have come back and written poetry. One of the Apollo guys did, too. You know, you wouldn't think of them so much. But yeah. That has a way always of invoking a different emotion of what a, you know, what someone who's good at crafting their words can say so much in just a few lines. But
and it is, how do you translate your experiences in a way that, you know, encompasses what you saw, what you felt, to try and share that with other people. You know, that's not easy. Not easy at all. And so we kind of touched on this a little bit, but space travel has always been in the news. You know, we were talking about how, you know, you were so glad to see that your students in this generation were still interested in the fact that you were in NASA and an astronaut. And I mentioned that it's because it's still relevant. I mean, there's still developments and missions and things happening in, you know, up to today. And it's changed so much. You know, it's always been kind of human intrigue, this idea of space. So more recently, if we think in the last several years, we've seen an increase in these privately funded expeditions. You know, it's not just a NASA thing. It's not just government. There are privately funded, expeditions that are trying to do the same thing. Talks of trips to space purely as tourism. You know, you don't have to just go on vacation to the beach anymore. One day you can go to Mars.
Maybe.
And of course, you know, mentioning Mars, more and more talk about setting up settlements in places like Mars one day in the distant future. So a lot of different ways that our relationship with space is changing. What are your thoughts on the future of humankind's relationship to what is off Earth?
And I'll still go back to the fact we all benefit now in ways just because we already have assets, you know, up there that we all use. I hope that going off Earth becomes affordable for everybody. I mean, I didn't have to pay to go, but I had to climb, you know, a ladder with different kinds of rungs, you know, the education, the experience, applying, the odds were low, versus paying tens of millions of dollars to go, you know, like $60 million for one of these. It's got to come down a lot. And there will always be an element of risk, you know, getting off the surface. But I think the more people, you know, that can see it, it's just, you know, sort of like when you're on a trip and you meet somebody you never knew that's maybe from your hometown. Oh, you were from the same place. Or maybe you're halfway around the world and they're from your state. And that's kind of amazing. But when once you get off the planet, you realize, oh, we're all on the same planet.
Yeah, that's really interesting, right?
I wish we could all have a sense of that connection, and that to me would be one of the biggest benefits of people getting to travel out. I mean, I don't know if we'll ever do settlements somewhere else because getting to Mars is still really hard. I can get a little technical in here. It's one-third the gravity on the surface of Mars, and it's going to require, you know, you have to go outside in protective gear for pressurization and being able to breathe. Someone born there could probably never come back to Earth. If they grew up in one-third gravity, they won't have the same stresses, you know, on their skeletal system. I mean, this is all some conjecture in my head and things I've read. So I'm getting a little off the topic of humanities. So where will people end up going? I mean, I don't know. But even visits would be fascinating. And, you know, and I hope that someday we can do some of our solar system like that, that some of these young kids growing up now, that maybe they will have a profession that takes them there for a while. Maybe they live there temporarily. We have such a beautiful planet. I don't know if I'd want to leave it permanently for something that's pretty barren. Sure. But, you know, what if you're a geologist or a scientist? And then once you have people living even in science communities temporarily, you need a structure and you need entertainment and you need probably lawyers.
I would think so.
I don't know how it's all going to unfold, but, you know, this is our home base, like, forever, and, that's an appreciation, I think, grows on people. The more they travel or the farther away your perspective gets to be from, you know, the seat you have, whether it's low Earth orbit or farther beyond, hopefully that people will be able to get.
I think the most striking thing that what you just mentioned is that one reason that you hope it is more accessible for the everyman to go to space for, I'm assuming we're talking more tourism than anything, is that you get that perspective of it's borderless.
Yeah.
You know, you get beyond that identity of I'm from this one little place. And you realize that, no, actually, we're all from this big place. And I love that kind of, you know, erasing conflict, erasing division, because you get the bigger perspective. Mm-hmm. So in just a couple sentences before we head into some audience and follower questions, why do you still find space exploration to be an important human endeavor? Why do we keep going, and why is understanding space so important to humankind?
I think it's just in us. I mean, why did we keep exploring? You know, why do we keep You know, we still send people to the South Pole. We still explore the depths of the ocean, which is just as challenging, you know, pretty challenging to get to. I don't know. We just have a curiosity and we learn new things. And we always think, what are we going to find out? You know, when we send, when the Artemis program, which is our return to the moon program that NASA's working on now, they're going to go to the lunar South Pole eventually. This is going to be a few years, but because we're really interested, there may be ice there that's existed, you know, since the beginning of the solar system. And there are some places there because just of the shadows and its orientation that have never seen sunlight. So the question is, what will it be? Does that intrigue your curiosity? You know, what's the benefit? Well, I, you know, to me, knowledge is benefit, but I think, you know, we don't know what we're going to find there. The unknowns and the questions are what are intriguing to me to keep going.
Okay. So this is a new endeavor for us with recording a podcast for Missouri Humanities in that, you know, this was kind of a first for us to, you know, break out of the humanities shell and want to do more of an interdisciplinary podcast episode. And so we really wanted to know, and obviously it's not every day you interview an astronaut. So we wanted to know what our followers would want to know. And then I also picked the brains of a couple teacher friends of mine to see what their students would want to know. So a few questions from our students were very similar, which I thought was interesting. So I might combine those a bit. But a few from social media, and these can be kind of like some rapid-fire Q&A.
Try to do rapid. I'm not so good at that.
So I'm really excited to dig into this. So Elise asked from Instagram, what was your absolute favorite moment in space and why?
I can't pick just one, Elise. Getting to do a spacewalk, looking back at our planet, I could... And there needs to be a short list, but I'll stop there.
Okay. Those are two pretty good ones. Okay. Michael asks, what did you find most helpful during your times in space? He lists examples like a certain diet or a mantra that you told yourself, certain relationships, activities, sleep training. What was most helpful to you?
All the simulations we did, you know, which were just practice before the thing and trying to keep on the timeline. And you can get through anything without a mantra, even, you know, when it's 7 to 14 days. I suspect if you ask the folks who are up there for 6 months or a year, they do have to rely on some inner mantras to get through that. But we just kept really busy.
Okay. Lori asks, what was the most challenging part of astronaut training?
The training for EVAs, we would be in the water tank, you know, for 6 or 7 hours under there in the suits. So that would get long.
Wow.
I would just say one water bag and no food.
Oh my gosh.
You know, so, but this was all still good stuff. And then we'd do what we sometimes called long duration sims to practice shift changes and mission control, because it'd be an integrated sim with all of these people. And the crew would then go home to sleep and come back, because some of these would run for like 36 hours. And so we'd just be in and out and just, yeah, so that kind of stuff.
Okay. Trey asks, what was the weirdest anomaly you saw in space?
And I don't know what to think about that. I didn't see any anomalies in space. I mean, it just
maybe
was...
that's a good thing. Huh? Maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah, I didn't see. I know. I'm so glad we didn't have a really big anomaly while I was up there. I mean, but I think I mentioned earlier we could see this, or maybe I didn't. The way our orbits were, we could also, you know, see the stars in the southern hemisphere. So one of the things I'd never seen before was like seeing some of those constellations. When we turned out our interior lights and dark adapted, you know, we could see that. I couldn't see it on the northern hemisphere perspective.
Okay, so getting into some student questions. So we have questions from Ms. Nichols' 8th grade class at Mexico Middle School in Audrain County, so not too far from where we are now. And then we also have Ms. Fitter's high school music students at University City High in St. Louis County. So some of the questions they ask, what's the food like?
Not bad. Getting better.
It's not just freeze-dried ice cream anymore.
Not fresh. One would be thinking of a fresh salad, you know, by the end of the trip. Didn't ever have the freeze-dried ice cream.
Oh.
But we could have, you know, ready-to-eat meals. We could have canned stuff and snacks and cookies and candies. A lot of stuff was rehydrated, which could be a little mushy. And we had a food warmer. So we could put together some pretty decent meals.
But fresh fruit and vegetables out of the question.
We could take a few fresh things in the pan, but we had a long drawer opening place in the mid deck that we called our pantry. Mm-hmm. And we would maybe launch with some apples in there and things. People said they learned not to do bananas because those get brown real, and there's an odor that you can't get rid of.
Yeah.
But we could take a few fresh things, but then those needed to be used.
Right,
you had
to use them quickly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A couple questions about how being in space affects physical and mental health, both going to space and then kind of transitioning back to Earth.
I'm a shorter duration space traveler mm-hmm. than the many month people we have right now in station. But physical health, it's bone loss, it's heart muscle strength, it's all muscles. You know, you lose some of the strength because you just don't do the normal everyday activities.
Sure.
And so heart. So there are various forms of exercise to help that, some supplements. But there's a cycle ergometer, there's a treadmill with a bungee system to hold somebody down. You know, there's a resistance trainer that uses something like hydraulic resistance. So exercise is really important. Eating right is important. Drinking enough is important. Does that sound familiar?
It does sound too different from what we're supposed to do.
Some of the ways for the physical challenges, there are some things they see that are, you know, they're waiting for people to see if they've recovered, like different body fluid pressures, like cerebral spinal. Some people get eyesight changes. Mentally, it was just a real big focus during the shorter shuttle missions. I think for somebody who's up a year, it must be really strange to come back and then all of a sudden have so many people around.
Sure.
But I can't really speak personally to that.
Mm-hmm. What do you do for fun? Now, I'm not sure if this student meant in general or what did you do for fun in space?
Well, let's just narrow it down a
sure.
bit. Again, the shuttle flights, we had a little bit of time off, but they were very focused and busy because we just had a few days. But frankly, for me, it was looking back at the Earth. And we would have meal times with all the crew together. You know, we joke around and talk. And on the space station, they do get like a day off. They get weekends, but that can be a catch-up time too. They watch movies. They have a couple of musical instruments up there. There's a keyboard. These are not things I got, you know, to use, but but it's up there. So
that's interesting.
They just can't go anywhere else.
Yeah. That would be, I think,
but
the really
hard part.
But
your view out the window keeps changing.
That's true. That's true. And that kind of leads to this one. What did space look like?
Yes. So it really depended on where you're looking. And so down below, we usually were in orientation. We had windows that looked down on the Earth. And, you know, it would turn below us very slowly because we're so far. It's actually, we're moving fast. If the Earth is turning, we're moving faster around it. But it seems slow because we're a few hundred miles away. So just there would be that view of our planet with oceans and land masses and then, you know, either city lights and storms at night with the sun down.
Oh, storms would be cool to see.
Yeah, you could see lightning going across hundreds of miles. We didn't want to look at the sun there either, just like you would not want to do it here.
Important message just before the eclipse.
Oh, yes. Never. Yeah, if you're going to do the eclipse on April 8th, get a good, you know, good pair of eclipse glasses,
yes.
which are inexpensive.
You can, right,
you know,
right.
You know. But we could see, but the sky itself just looks black. There's no blue sky, of course, because we're above the air. So the sky looks black. If we dark adapted, we could see stars. They don't look any closer, maybe a slight bit of clarity. I had a couple of missions where the orbit was, you know, slanted with the equator. We call it inclination. And so if we were in dark time up north or south, you could see you could see northern or southern lights a little bit. But a lot of it could just be black. If you just looked out and you're not looking at the Earth and there's lights on inside, it just looks dark. It just looks black. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and this, I'm not sure if you can condense this, but if you could, what kind of missions were you on or projects were you part of?
Well, projects is a bigger question. So missions were my first flight, we deployed an astronomical observatory that collected gamma rays. That's real high energy radiation that comes in from big events out in other galaxies and our own. The second one was an Earth science mission with a radar of microwave wavelengths that bounced off the Earth. My third mission, we had an extra science laboratory back in the cargo bay that was connected to our airlock so we could float back there. And we had some science experiments for the European Space Agency and we docked with the Russian Mir space station. We caught up with it in orbit and docked with it. That it's no longer there, but it was on that flight. And my last flight was, and we did a spacewalk on that one, and there's robotics on the missions. In my last flight, we were taking up supplies and a crew to the International Space Station, and we docked with them for several days, and we had a module in our cargo bay we had to lift out with robotic arm and put it on station and unload it and reload it and put it back and exchange the crew and do a spacewalk. And that's about as quick as I can do it.
That's pretty cool, though.
You know, the key thing there, it was always different. So there was more training, more education, more learning for every mission. That never stopped. Mm-hmm. And that's good. Mm-hmm. You want that in your life, right?
Yes.
Something new all the time.
Right. How did it feel to readjust to gravity on Earth?
Oh, it felt heavy. I mean, and this is even after my muscles didn't get all that weak in a week.
Week in a week?
Thanks, English language, for letting me come up with that phrase. But the brain really scales back. Our brains scale back. There's a neurological change that just says, I don't have to lift that very hard. And that's because if you go to lift it hard, it tends to...
So kind of like when you think a box is heavier than it is and you put too much effort in and it flies up.
Yeah, it just flies up. And so so up there, you learn not to lift anything with much effort, but being... never forgetting there's still mass with it. So if it's something that, you can pick up a brick or a feather and it's going to weigh the same in an Earth orbit, free fall orbit, but which one's going to hurt somebody? That part of it is still there.
Which one's going to hurt somebody?
So you just learn how to handle things and everything just seems real. And you learn to throw things differently because it doesn't have an arc to it anymore. And so people come back and they've like tried to, flip a pencil or throw a pen and it doesn't do right. But it's pretty adaptable. We are just such adaptable creatures, evidently. We learn to do it up there, and we readapt when we come back. So that was just, but it definitely is the brain is saying, okay, you're tricking me. You made me learn this, and now I got to like relearn what I already knew. Mm-hmm. And some people might notice this. If they're out on the ocean for a while on a boat, or you come back, the ground feels different. Or if you go skating for a while, like roller skating, and then you stop skating, Are you in the water swimming for a long time and you get out? There's just
a difference.
There's a difference. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, last question. And it's, I guess, the ultimate question for an astronaut, which is, what made you want to become an astronaut? And you kind of touched on it earlier, but I think for our students, what made you want to do this?
I thought it seemed exciting. I just wanted to be there. It seemed the ultimate. And I knew that I couldn't go and travel to these places that I read about, like when I read books or I thought about it. But I could do, NASA was the closest thing to me that just was an exciting adventure. And
the ultimate adventure.
The ultimate adventure. And then I will just real quickly say to close, and what I found out looking back was it was, and the space flights were the highlights, but what ended up being the best was like all the people I worked with, because that was where I spent most of my time. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Linda Godwin, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time, for being willing to answer a very wide array of questions from both myself and from our students and followers. I'm really excited to share your story and to really help bridge the gap that I think is closing more and more between STEM and the humanities. So thank you for being part of that.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Caitlin. Good questions.
Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to the Missouri Marvels podcast from Missouri Humanities. We invite you to engage with us further by following Missouri Humanities on social media at @MoHumanities or subscribing to our streaming platform, Humanities TV, at h-tv.org. Or you can learn more about us at mohumanities.org. We'll be back again soon with more marvelous guests and stellar conversations.